Welcome to today's edition of The Bible Class. Our teacher, Dr. Kenneth C. Hill, is teaching from the Old Testament book of Exodus. You may send your questions by email through our website at whcbradio.org. That's whcbradio.org, or by the Postal Service at The Bible Class, care of WHCB, Post Office Box 5, Bluffville, Tennessee, 37617. And now, here is Dr. Hill with today's lesson.
Welcome to the Bible Class. We are in our study of the book of Exodus, the second book of the Old Testament. It is the way out for the children of Israel. They're going to be leaving their bondage in Egypt, and we're going to be reading about that throughout the book of Exodus. It is an extremely exciting story. I realize it'll take us a while to get through it, but it is an exciting time for the children of Israel. Now, in Exodus chapter 1 and in chapter 2, we see that that the children of Israel are in bondage in Egypt. As the book opens, there's been 3.5 centuries passing from the closing scene of Genesis, where Joseph is in a coffin in Egypt, and the opening of Exodus with the phrase, now, or and, these are the children of Israel. And so we see a great change in 3.5 centuries. The book of Genesis is a family history. The book of Exodus becomes the national history. We don't have any account of what happened in that 3.5 centuries. We do know that the patriarch Abraham died when Jacob, his grandson, was 15 years old. Jacob's favorite son, Joseph, had been sold as a slave into Egypt and had risen to great power and influence. The sons of Jacob had gained great favor because of their brother Joseph. We also know that there were only 70 people that went down into Egypt that were the family. When they were ready to leave Egypt, the people had grown to a nation. Now, the nation had grown from 70 in a family to 3 million people. Now, what does that tell you? That tells you they were prosperous and they multiplied due to that prosperity. They must not have had very much hardship in 3.5 centuries. However, after Joseph died, there was a new dynasty that came to the throne of Egypt, and in the last maybe 100 years, maybe 70 years, there was bondage for these people. Now, when this new dynasty came to the throne, the wealth and great numbers of the children of Israel made them objects of suspicion in the eyes of the Egyptian rulers. So the pharaohs, as they came and went, wanted to break with them and reduce them to a slavery of the worst sort. They no longer revered them, respected them, or even thought well of them, but they wanted to despise them, and that's what they were doing. Now, this was hard for a people who had lived as free men with every favor of the nation given to them. They remembered the promises that God had given to Abraham and his descendants, and it made this bondage doubly hard to understand. Now, if you want to go back to Genesis, and let's go to chapter 12, Genesis chapter 12, and if you have the opportunity, join us. We begin reading at verse 1. Now the Lord had said unto Abram, get thee out of thy country and from thy kindred, from thy father's house, unto a land that I will show thee, and I will make of thee a great nation, and I will bless thee, and make thy name great, and thou shalt be a blessing. And I will bless them that bless thee, and curse them that curseth thee, and in thee shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Now, this was just the first of many of these promises that were given to Abraham and his descendants. And, of course, we knew that the descendants were to be as the sand of the sea in number. Well, the story told in the books of the Pentateuch, that's the Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, show that God did not forget the promise which he made to Abraham. That verse 2 of chapter 12 that we just read in Genesis, I will make of thee a great nation. He didn't forget that, and he is ready to do so. The family records of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob no doubt had been carried into Egypt. They had become a part of Israel's national fabric. They were well known. They were repeated and repeated. So through the long years of bondage, they clung to the promise that one day Canaan would be their home. That was the promised land. So we'll see God in Exodus coming down to deliver the people from Egypt. We'll see that in Exodus chapter 3. So the individuals and families had been organized into a nation, and God was going to give them laws with which to govern themselves. He was going to take them back to the land where he had promised them. And that's what the Exodus is all about. Now, if you think that the Exodus was conceived and contrived by Pharaoh and had nothing to do with God's plan, you're wrong. It was not by Pharaoh's hand that they left. If you think that it was conceived by Moses, and Moses, in some fashion, had been trained to remove them and to take them out of the land, you would be wrong, because God is the one who put it all together. It is God that chose for Pharaoh to do the things that he did. It's God that chose for Moses to do the things that he did, and for the children of Israel to do the things that they did. Yes, God was at the center of the Exodus. He had promised them great status as a nation, as a great nation, and they were going to become that great nation. All right, in Exodus chapter 2, and there went a man of the house of Levi and took to wife a daughter of Levi. And the woman conceived and bare a son, and when she saw him, that he was a goodly child, she hid him 3 months. And when she could not longer hide him, she took for him an ark of bulrushes, and daubed it with slime and with pitch, and put the child therein, and she laid it in the flags by the river's brink. And his sister stood afar off, to wit what would be done to him. And the daughter of Pharaoh came down to wash herself at the river, and her maidens walked along by the river's side. And when she saw the ark among the flags, she sent her maid to fetch it. Now notice, this is a mother who is wanting to save her son. And so she put together this basket. It was a little ark. It was a little basket that was going to be used to carry Moses along. And she made sure it was watertight. She put the child in there, and she put it by the bulrushes, right on the edge of the river, not where the river was flowing fast or anything of the such. This was just so he could be safe, and he would also be found, by the way. So when the daughter of Pharaoh came down to bathe, she and her maidens were there. The maidens were walking along by the riverside, making sure that they would not be disturbed, and making sure of security, making sure of cleanliness, making sure of a lot of things that were their jobs to do. And they saw this little basket among the bulrushes, and she saw it too, so she sent her maids to bring it out. Verse 6, and when she had opened it, she saw the child, and behold, the babe wept. And she had compassion on him, and said, "This is one of the Hebrews' children." Then said his sister to Pharaoh's daughter, Miriam was right there, "Shall I go and call to thee a nurse of the Hebrew women, that she may nurse the child for thee?" And Pharaoh's daughter said to her, "Go." And the maid went and called the child's mother. And Pharaoh's daughter said unto her, "Take this child away and nurse it for me, and I will give thee thy wages." And the woman took the child and nursed it. And the child grew, and she brought him unto Pharaoh's daughter, and he became her son. And she called his name Moses. And she said, "Because I drew him out of the water." Now Moses, since his mother and his father both were from the tribe of Levi, was from the tribe of Levi. Not very difficult to figure that out, is it? Now his brother Aaron will be the head of the Levitical priesthood when this thing gets going. So anyway, he was saved from Pharaoh's edict to destroy the Hebrew male infants by the mother. And she was a wonderful lady. And then by his sister, who was there to watch and to help, and by Pharaoh's own daughter. He was raised in the court of Pharaoh, trained in the wisdom of the Egyptians, according to Acts chapter 7. He later ran from Egypt, went to the land of Midian in the Sinai wilderness. We'll see that in verse 15 in just a moment. There he married a woman named Zipporah, the daughter of Reuel, or Jethro. Then he had a meeting with God at a burning bush, a bush that burned but did not consume, on Mount Sinai, there in Exodus chapter 3 that we'll read. Then he returned to Egypt to lead the great exodus of Israel back to the Promised Land. In the wilderness of Sinai, he received the law directly from God. He oversaw the building of the tabernacle and the institution of Israel's feasts and offerings. He finally viewed the Promised Land from Mount Nebo and was buried by God in the land of Moab when he was 120 years of age. Now Moses later came back, appearing, representing the law at the transfiguration of Christ. You find that in Matthew chapter 17, verse 36. And as I turn the page here in Scripture, I am reminded that Moses was unique. Not only was he drawn out of the water, he was saved for a purpose. And indeed, we have been called for a purpose as well as Moses has. Maybe not for the same task. I don't think the children of Israel need to come out of bondage today in the same sense. But we have been called to do Christ's work. Remember what I told you in the last session about Dwight L. Moody. He is the one that gets the quotation that Moses spent 40 years thinking he was somebody. That was when he was in the court of the Pharaoh. He had 40 years learning he was nobody. That's when he was on the backside of the desert in Midian, taking care of the sheep and goats. And then 40 years discovering what God can do with a nobody. A somebody, thinking he was a somebody, then learning he was a nobody, and then learning what God can do with a nobody. And it took 120 years for that. And the Lord is working with you too, my friend. Is it going to take 120 years? I wonder. And whatever it takes, it's worth it to learn what Christ would have you to be doing for him. All right, verse 11. And it came to pass in those days, when Moses was grown, that he went out unto his brethren and looked on their burdens. And he spied an Egyptian smiting an Hebrew, one of his brethren. And he looked this way and that way, and when he saw there was no man, he slew the Egyptian and hid him in the sand. And when he went out the second day, behold, two men of the Hebrews strove together, and he said to him that did the wrong, "Wherefore smitest thou thy fellow?" And this one who had done the wrong, he said, "Who made thee a prince and a judge over us? Intendest thou to kill me as thou killedst the Egyptian?" And Moses feared and said, "Surely this thing is known." Now this is interesting, before we go any further, just to note that Moses was a man of passion. He was a soldier. He knew very well how to kill people. He was a general of the Egyptian army, and he was well known as being a great, victorious general. Now, verse 15, "Now when Pharaoh heard this thing, he sought to slay Moses. But Moses fled from the face of Pharaoh and dwelt in the land of Midian, and he sat down by a well." He fled. He was on the loose. "Now the priest of Midian had 7 daughters, and they came and drew water and filled the troughs to water their father's flock. And the shepherds came and drove them away. But Moses stood up and helped them and watered their flock. And when they came to Reuel, their father, he said, 'How is it that you are come so soon today?' And they said, 'An Egyptian delivered us out of the hand of the shepherds and also drew water enough for us and watered the flock.' And he said unto his daughters, 'And where is he? Why is it that ye have left the man? Call him, that he may eat bread.' And Moses was content to dwell with a man, and he gave Moses Zipporah his daughter. And she bare him a son, and he called his name Gershom, for he said, I have been a stranger in a strange land. And it came to pass in process of time that the king of Egypt died, and the children of Israel sighed by reason of the bondage, and they cried, and their cry came up unto God by reason of the bondage. And God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, with Isaac, and with Jacob. And God looked upon the children of Israel, and God had respect unto them. That's the second chapter. Let's look at some of the phrasing here in this second chapter and study what the Lord has given us. The phrase, the daughter of Pharaoh, has been interpreted by many to refer to the famous Hatshepsut, who was important in the history of Egypt. That would have been from 1504 to 1483 B.C., and that would consider it to be an early date for Exodus. Moses would have had to be born around 1527 B.C., and this would be during the reign of this woman's father, Thutmose I. She was his only daughter, and when her father died, she became queen, having been married to a half-brother, Thutmose II. And after his death, she had herself crowned king, that we would say queen, but she said king, with full pharaoh powers, with the regalia, the title, and everything else, to be the king. So she was the pharaoh. And so she refused for 20 years to allow her stepson, Thutmose III, to rule. But while a lot of folks think that's the case, there's also a good possibility that Moses was reared in one of the royal harems, which were common in the New Kingdom period. The Egyptian kings maintained residences and harems not only in the great capitals of Thebes, Memphis, and Ramses, but also in other parts of Egypt. The harem supervised a great deal of domestic industry, like spinning and weaving done by the servants. The children of harem women would be educated by the overseer of the harem. And in due time, princes, he was called her son, were given a tutor who was officially a high official, in the court. Maybe they were a retired military officer that was close to the king. The fact that he became her son may merely indicate that he had rejoined the royal court. Having done so, he was in a position to receive all the privileges and all of the opportunities of a member of the court. The king of Egypt that died would have been Thutmose III, the pharaoh of the oppression of the Hebrew children. Now, Midian was in the desert region between Sinai and the Arabian desert south of Edom. Its exact location is still unknown. Its population was nomadic, and yet they had places that they went back to. They could call them cities, you might say, but they were truly semi-nomadic. Midian is listed as one of Abraham's sons by his wife Keturah, who was sent to the land of Kittim in Genesis 25. In the story of Joseph in Genesis 37, the designation of Midianites and Ishmaelites were virtually interchangeable. During the wilderness journey of the Israelites, the Midianites appear in confederation with the Moabites and the Amorites. By the time of Gideon, in Judges chapter 6, the Midianites appear as desert bandits in alliance with the Amalekites. Their recorded devastation by Gideon's forces may well account for the fact that they disappear from the biblical record after Gideon's victory. No substantial archaeological evidence has ever been found of these nomads because they really didn't have cities of any size by which to find them later and to look for their broken pottery and their various tools and weapons that might have been left on the ground. Archaeologists have a hard time finding something that really never was there. They were so nomadic that they would use the either woven tents or camel skins woven together as tents, and of course they would be gone with very short time in the desert sands. And so we know from chapter 2 that God was looking down upon the children of Israel and respecting them, having respect unto them, which means he was looking forward to the time of releasing them from their bondage.
Thank you for joining us today for this edition of the Bible Class with Dr. Kenneth C. Hill. You may reach us by email by going to our website, whcbradio.org, and sending us an email on the Contact Us link. That's whcbradio.org. If you prefer to use the postal service, our address is The Bible Class, WHCB, Post Office Box 5, Bluntville, Tennessee 37617. That's The Bible Class, care of WHCB, Post Office Box 5, Bluntville, Tennessee 37617. You may also call us at 423-878-6279. Until our next Bible Class program, we are trusting that the Lord will richly bless you as you serve Him.